Every year, the University of Kansas honors a journalist at its William Allen White Day. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, CBS reporter and correspondent Bob Schieffer. Later this hour, we'll hear from sports journalist Frank DeFord, who announced his retirement from NPR last week. DeFord was honored at KU's William Allen White Day back in 2013. But first, the National Citation is awarded annually to a journalist who, quote, exemplifies the ideals of William Allen White in service to his profession and his community. The University of Kansas honored the famed editor of the Emporia Gazette on April 20, 2017. This year's National Citation winner was Charlie Rose, who appears nightly on public television. Rose recently underwent heart surgery and was unable to attend William Allen White Day, so accepting the award on his behalf was his friend and colleague, Bob Schieffer. Schieffer has been a reporter and correspondent for more than 60 years, having worked for CBS News and Face the Nation. He's won almost every award in broadcast journalism and is the author of several books. His latest is Overload: Finding Truth in the Deluge of News. It comes out this fall. He was joined on stage by University of Kansas journalism student Jackson Kurtz.
Well, let's get right into it. You know, you've had a really long, impressive career. You've covered every administration since Nixon, countless interviews, stories, and scandals. What's some of the highlights of your career, something that sticks out to you?
Well, what sticks out to me is I'm still here. I mean, let's put the lead up at the top of the story, right? I just had so much fun. And before I say that, get into that, let me just say a word about Charlie. I was very honored to be asked to fill in for Charlie. Charlie is a unique person in journalism. He has become the person that people want to interview him. And the reason for that is there's two reasons. Charlie is a person of real integrity, and Charlie gives the people he interviews a chance to answer the questions that he asks them. That's become kind of a rare thing in journalism lately, but Charlie always does that. And I think this is a great thing two ways. I think William Allen White being connected in the same sentence with Charlie Rose, I think he's in good company. And I think Charlie Rose is in excellent company to be in the same sentence with Kansas University. So thank you all for picking Charlie. You couldn't have made a better choice. And I'm happy to be here to represent him. You know, when I look back on my career and or whatever it was, my life, I've been doing this now since I was 20 years old. I've gotten a paycheck every week for the last 60 years for doing something connected with journalism, including the 3 years I was in the Air Force where I flew the LSD, the large steel desk. I was the editor of the base newspaper at Travis Air Force Base in California and other journalism-related jobs. And I would just say this. When I look back, what were the significant stories I covered? I was there at the assassination of President Kennedy. I covered Watergate. I later went to Vietnam and I moderated three presidential debates. Those are the, I guess you would put, if you were going to put on a resume what you've done, those were the things I'd put there. But what I think of are the things that journalism gave me an opportunity to enjoy. And one of the most fun things I've done in all the years I've been at CBS News is 3 weeks ago, I think it was, on Sunday morning, I did an interview with Willie Nelson. Willie is 84 years old. He does 100 shows a year. He's written over 1,000 songs. He's just put out his 110th album, just still going strong. And people ask me this question, so I asked Willie, I said, when are you going to quit? When are you going to retire? And he said, what do I want to quit? He said, all I do is play golf and play a little music. He said, why would I want to quit doing either one of those things? So it's kind of been my philosophy. Willie's new song in his new album is Woke Up Again Today Still Not Dead, which I can sort of relate to. And that's kind of my my view of things. When I talk to young people about what they want to do, journalism is a very important thing, and I hope you'll ask me about that. But the other part of it is, I can't think of anything that I could have had more fun doing than get to be a reporter and get to go the places I went and interview and talk to the people I did. And that's what I always say to students. You know, there's a lot of real pressure on young people these days to make a success. In other words, make money. And I tell them, don't worry about that part of it. Pick out something you really like to do. And if you get good at it, whether it's journalism or something else, the success part will take care of itself. And the other part that I try to stress to them is, at your age, you can start out in one direction, and if it doesn't work out, you can always change and try something else. I mean, when you need to start worrying about time and changes when you get to be my age. But to these students here at the school, like you, Jackson, the sun in your sky is way over here. The sun in my sky is way over here. What you don't want to do is when the sun in your sky is over here, say, you know, I really wish I'd tried doing that, what I really had a dream about, but I thought I couldn't do it. But, you know, I might have could have done it if I'd have just tried. So I really urge young people, don't be afraid to stretch. Don't be afraid to follow your dream. And most of all, don't let anyone talk you out of your dream. And there are always people who will. There are still people who tell me I can't do something. And those people, I used to think I had to get even with them. Then I realized, no, they're not worth that. You just don't think about them. Mm-hmm. Think about the people who encouraged you along the way. Those are your real friends, and those are the people you want to remember.
And that kind of brings me to, you knew Walter Cronkite.
I did.
And he was a mentor of yours.
He certainly was.
Does that mentorship continue in newsrooms and the media markets today of, you know, taking the side of young journalists and kind of showing them the ropes?
It does if you look for it. Mm-hmm. And there are people who want to help. But the great thing about Walter was that Walter didn't go around telling people how to do their jobs. He just did his job, and he set such a good example. Walter Cronkite was the single most curious person I have ever known, and that's why he was such a great editor. He could always think of the question that no one else thought to ask. And I remember one time, it was 6:25, the news goes on at 6:30. Walter looked up from his copy and said, "How long is Greenland?" Well, who knows how long Greenland is? Who cares how long Greenland is? But Walter could always come up with a question that nobody else thought to ask. And he set such an example. He was so enthusiastic about, he loved the news. And he, one time we were in London and we just fed our pieces at the BBC studios and we were going back to the hotel and a police car came around us with a siren. And I'd never heard a human being on earth ever say this, but Walter knocked on the window of the cab and said, "Follow that car." And we did. And of course, when we got there, it was just a car wreck. And Walter said, "Well, we can't be too careful here. Just would you mind, Bob, getting out and checking it out?" And so I did, of course. But that's what made Walter what he was. And people, I think that came across. People understood that Walter didn't think he was smarter than everybody else, but Walter had done his homework. Mm-hmm. And Walter was always trying to find the answers. And to me, that's who I wanted to be when I was a young reporter. I wanted to be Walter Cronkite. And I still want to be Walter Cronkite. I think just doing your job and doing it right and being enthusiastic about it. And as I tell these kids, show up on time. That's also another very important part of it. And Walter always did. Young people, without even realizing it, that's influencing them because they're observing the other people. And those of us who are of an age should always remember that. These kids are watching us, and they're smart. They're a lot smarter than I was because they know a lot more because there's a lot more to know. And I feel a responsibility to try to help them when I can, and I hope I do. Mm.
Speaking of a lot more to know, the administration today, the last campaign, we just had an interesting time there.
Yeah.
How does that, covering that, what was that like? There, you know.
Well, this was a campaign that was unlike any campaign that I can remember in my lifetime. I mean, this was a campaign, I've never seen such an unusual campaign. I mean, this was a campaign where one candidate, Jeb Bush, goes out and raises $115 million. It had absolutely no impact. This was a campaign where Hillary Clinton, when asked why she had taken $600,000 in speaking fees, said, well, that's what they offered. I mean, was there nobody to say, maybe there are several other ways you could explain that? I mean, who would say that? But it was one. But my favorite moment in this campaign, the most unusual part of this campaign, was when John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, said that Ted Cruz was Lucifer in the flesh. And the Devil Worshipper Society denied it. They did. You can look it up. Google it. You'll find it. We've never had anything like that. We've never had anything like that. In a more serious way, we're in the midst of this technological revolution, this digital age, that has not only just changed the way we get our news, but it's having a profound impact on our culture. I think as profound as the invention of the printing press. I mean, I really sincerely believe that. And we're right in the middle of it right now. You think about the printing press, and you know, Martin Luther said that the printing press was God's finest, extremist gift. And it caused the Protestant Reformation to happen, the Counter-Reformation. But we also had 30 years of religious wars before society finally reached equilibrium. We are not there yet. We're in the midst of this thing. We don't know how it's going to go finally come out, but we know it has had, you know, it's driving newspapers as we used to know them out of business. I think paper newspapers will come to an end maybe in the next 10 years. But it is also, you know, we're getting more information than we've ever had at any time in the history of the world. But are we wiser, or are we just getting so much information we can't process it? I think right now there's just so much information that we can't process it. So it's not all good, but it is good. There are some great things happening here, but there are also some things that, you know, for one thing, now all the nuts can find one another, and that that in itself presents certain problems. But against that background, we had this campaign. Mm-hmm. And now we have the Trump presidency. And I mean, I'll just cut to the chase here. I think what concerns me right now is the credibility of the White House and the credibility of the office of the president. You know, we live in very, very dangerous times, perhaps as dangerous as it's been since maybe the Cuban Missile Crisis and back in there. And when the President of the United States comes on television, we want to be able to believe what he tells us. And I think that is very important, number one, for our national security, and also for the reassurance of the American people. And I mean, when we have this thing like we had the other day, where we're talking about sending this armada of naval vessels to the shores of North Korea. Well, in the first place, the United States Navy has not used the word armada in about 200 years, as far as I know. And then when we find out that not only were the ships not going to the shores of North Korea, but were 3,500 miles away, going in the opposite direction. And then we hear the White House spokesman come out the next day and say, well, we didn't mislead anyone. You just had to listen carefully to what we say. To me, that poses a certain danger, a serious danger. And I think I would like it if the president could kind of go light on some of these tweets sometimes until he can kind of check it out and see if in fact they're true. I mean, I thought it was interesting the other day, Kellyanne Conway, who coined the phrase alternate truth, I believe it was.
Alternate facts.
Yeah. Alternate facts, was saying that the reporting coming out of the White House was not fact-based. And I think if you go back and look at the reporting of recent weeks, probably the reporting is more fact-based than some of the statements that have been coming from the president and the president's own spokesman. But these are things that one hopes that they will shake out. We all want this president to be successful because we all want the United States of America to be successful. But right now, there's just such a lack of coordination and confusion. Part of that is because at this point, only the Secretary of Defense, he is the only ranking official at the Pentagon who's now been confirmed. General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, is kind of camping out over there by himself. He's got the uniformed military, but he doesn't have any aides around him. And then you go to the State Department and it's even worse, where they don't have a military service. It's still in place there, and they've discharged so many. And you have a Secretary of Defense, who I think is a very smart and intelligent man, but who has not been in government before, and is sometimes seems unfamiliar with the process. And I think the president himself, charitably, one could say he is strikingly unfamiliar with a lot of the processes of how the government operates. So I'm hoping all this kind of levels out, but right now there seems to be considerable chaos, and I don't think that's very good.
Mm-hmm. Many Americans look to you and other journalists during the election and during this time as, you know, someone who has a voice, and you said a lot of feelings that they were saying, and I'm one of the quotes you said was, you know, was the worst election of your lifetime, and
I think it was.
Yeah.
I still believe that. I have not ended my remarks.
But I bring that up because you said for younger generations, kind of become a drinking game, that every time that you or a journalist would say that it's the worst election of our lifetime, take a shot. And you know what? I'm here to tell you that.
Luckily, we had designated drivers at CBS because I said it a lot. Yeah, but.
No, like I felt like I was in the Twilight Zone, and you know, Rod Serling was going to come out at any moment and say you're in a different dimension, but he just never came out, and it just kept going. But what was it like to be that voice for so many people who they wanted to express how they felt and have these feelings and say these things towards a certain candidate or towards a campaign or Trump administration?
The Trump people obviously took great exception to a lot that we did, and even after he was elected, we had Mr. Bannon saying it was time for the press to sit down and shut up, that they were not the opposition party. That, to me, represents a total misunderstanding of the role of the press. And let me just, the one point I'd like to, if you don't remember anything else I say, and if you want to disagree with everything I say, that's fine too. But just remember this, the difference between a totalitarian society and a democracy is this. In a totalitarian society, there is only one source of news, one source of information, and that is the government. In a democracy like ours, citizens get independently gathered accurate information, and that's what comes from the press, that they can compare to the government's version of events and then decide what to do about it. And that's what our role is. That's what the founders intended for us to do. We are there to present an alternative to the government's version of events. And then people can say, well, that's totally wrong, or maybe it's half right, or the government's entirely right. That's fine. It's the role of the government to run the government. It's the role of the press to ask questions about what the government is doing. Politicians present a message. Our role is to question that message and determine if in fact it's true, and if it's not, to report that. I don't know any reporter who thinks that we are some sort of opposition party. No one thinks that. Our role is simply to ask questions and to keep asking questions until we get answers. We're not always going to be the most popular person in the room, but that is what the founders intended when they invented this wonderful system of government that we had. And I think that's what we have to continue to do.
And you've interviewed President Trump before he was president, obviously, multiple times.
I have. The first time I interviewed him was about 30 years ago when he, and it was a great story. The city of New York had spent $11 million and could not get the ice to freeze over in that skating rink in Central Park. And Trump, who was a young developer, came along and said, "Let me have the job. I'll get it done." And in 3 months, he had the ice frozen and he had people skating in Central Park. And it was a great story. It was a story about how sometimes, you know, private enterprise can triumph over government bureaucracy and all of that. And I did that story and he loved that story. And I've had different interviews with him over the years, and sometimes he likes me and sometimes he doesn't. And I've learned to live with that. it's kind of part of what we do. But he's generally, it depends on what kind of a mood he's in, he's generally very interesting to interview. But he is first and foremost a real estate promoter. Mm-hmm. And I think you just have to, and I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but you have to remember that. He says in all his life, he has been saying whatever it took to close the deal. And that's not how you can act as president. The president's job is to persuade. The presidency is a place of leadership. It's not a place of management. The president has to hire the managers to run the place. And I think what he's having problems with is he has always run his businesses as kind of a mom and pop operation, on a big scale. But he didn't delegate very much. It was all amongst the family. And I think now he's trying to figure out how to put that model into place to run the government. And I'm not sure that model is going to work, but I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing so much of this infighting that you're hearing about going on within the administration as to who's going to come out on top. I mean, maybe I've watched too many Godfather movies, but my money's on the family. I think in the end, they will be his closest advisors. Mm-hmm.
And going off Trump here for a second on the administration, is there someone that you really would want to interview or a story that you would love to cover?
Yeah, I'd like to interview the Pope. This Pope. Mm-hmm. I think he's just fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be a lot of fun to talk to him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I'd like to interview President Trump. If he called me up and said, "Come over here, well, I'll give you an interview," I'd go over there. I mean, that's what reporters do. You go find out. And the biggest mistake that young reporters make is that they're sometimes reluctant to ask questions because they think, oh, if I ask him that question, he'll think I'm dumb. The biggest mistakes that I have ever made is when I assumed that I knew what the person I was interviewing was going to say. That's the second thing that reporters have to be aware of. You never assume you know what the answer you're going to get. You may think you have a pretty good idea, but you never assume, because when you do, that's when the next person that comes along scoops you. And so I always advise young reporters, you know, never be afraid to ask because they'll think you're dumb. Just ask the question. And never assume you know what the answer is going to be.
Well, is there a moment that you've been on live TV and something embarrassing has happened to you or to someone else, or a story that you've come across?
I think I can tell this story, and as I'm telling it, I'll try to go through it in my head to figure out if I can, how I'm going to tell this. But yes, there was. When the Star Report came out about Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton, and we got a little scoop on it. We got the report from a congressman, and I was up on the Hill, and we went on live on television. And the congressman wouldn't let us have the whole report, but he would let us Xerox it in his Xerox machine one page at a time. So we set up kind of a little bucket brigade, and these kids would, you know, pass this thing page by page, and they'd pass it to me. And Mary Hager, who is now the producer of Face the Nation and was quite young in those days and was working as my producer up on Capitol Hill, she was sitting down on the floor, and she would just glance at it and then hand it up to me. And so I'm on live television, and I'm reading, and they hand me this thing, and I look down at it, and I say, and then Dan was in New York. I said, and then Dan, he unzipped his, and then I stopped, and I looked up, and I said, Dan, how about letting me look at this for a minute, and then and then I looked back, and then I looked up and said, and then they had sex of a kind. Now, I don't know where this phrase came from. I'd never heard it in my life. I didn't know where it came from, but it just kind of came out of my mouth. And because there was a certain form of sex that I didn't know if you could say that live on television. Nobody had ever said it live on television before. But anyway, that...
that beats them. That beats
you. Talk about embarrassing and not knowing what to say or do. That I think that would probably have to be it.
But yeah, you mentioned earlier for young journalists, you know, find a certain style and, you know, copy that. And do you think that currently with the administration, with everything going on, this, you know, so many media outlets, how do we continue to do that? How do we?
Well, you know what I think? I think we may see a renaissance of investigative journalism. There's nothing like a really good story to bring out the best in journalism. I mean, where did Woodward and Bernstein come from? You know, I mean, here's these two kids. Neither one of them had ever set foot in the White House. And in fact, this is an interesting little fact that I didn't realize is, throughout the entire Watergate story, Woodward and Bernstein never once attended a White House briefing. Wow. They were doing the old-fashioned kind of journalism at night, waiting till people got home and knocking on the door and asking them questions. And it was a good lesson for us there. I mean, you know, when the White House, remember, they went through all this stuff, well, we might not have the briefings and we might have them across the street. And my answer was, fine, have the briefings wherever you want to, and we'll send somebody to cover them wherever you want to hold them. But you're not going to reduce the intensity of our scrutiny by saying we can't come to the White House briefing. I mean, who cares? I mean, it might, you know, if somebody said you can't come to a White House briefing, I might say, what is second prize? I mean, that's not on my bucket list. I want to tell you, and I've been around here for a long time, but you know, what we have to do is just keep focused on what we do, and that is just keep asking questions. Don't be arrogant about it. We have to always remember we should never leave the impression that we're the fount of all wisdom or that we're the arbiters of all morality. We're not. We're just simply there to ask the people in power why they do what they do and to give us an explanation so we can explain it to people.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, you're so welcome, and thank you all very much for having me.
You've just heard CBS newsman Bob Schieffer, along with University of Kansas journalism student Jackson Kurtz. They spoke April 20th, 2017 at Woodruff Auditorium at the University of Kansas as part of KU's William Allen White Day. Schieffer was accepting the William Allen White National Citation on behalf of his friend and colleague, Charlie Rose, who was unable to attend due to recent surgery. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. If you missed last week's KPR Presents, a community conversation on concealed weapons on college campuses with KPR News Director Jay Schieffer, it's now archived on our website. Go to kpr.ku.edu/news. There you can find most previous KPR Presents programs, including last month's special, A Nation Engaged, a discussion at the Truman Presidential Library and Museum in Independence, Missouri, on how much power should the president, any president have. Again, that's at kpr.ku.edu under News and KPR Presents. For the rest of this hour, we'll hear from another honoree at William Allen White Day. Sports journalist Frank DeFord won the National Citation in 2013, the first and only sports writer to do so. DeFord recently announced his retirement after 37 years on NPR's Morning Edition. He's the author of 18 books. His most recent was Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer. His comments were originally broadcast on Kansas Public Radio on March 24, 2013.
I'm so honored on this anniversary of William Allen White's 145th birthday. I'm so gratified to receive this extraordinary distinction, even if I imagine that Mr. White and I differ in almost every respect. I think that the gentleman might be very dubious about my choice here today. First of all, I am the first journalist ever to be so honored. And at the same time, Mr. White wrote in his autobiography, "Athletics did not interest me even remotely." And if he ever so much as broke a sweat himself, it is not evident. Mr. White was a genuine small-town Midwesterner. I'm a big city slicker from the East. He was a newspaper man. I come mostly from magazines. He was a devout Republican. I'm a stalwart Democrat. He was short and fat. I'm tall and skinny. There is the one terribly tragic connection that we have that sadly we both lost our beloved daughters when they were children. And happily, though, this too. Both of us simply wrote an awful lot of things. A lot of stuff about a lot of stuff. So there is that connects us. And one other thing, too. In 1896, as you all know, Mr. White became instantly well-known outside of Kansas for his famous editorial, What's the Matter with Kansas? In 1967, I became instantly well-known within the state of Kansas, lionized, glorified, for writing in a national magazine that the KU cheerleaders were the best looking in the country. So, how happy I am to return to be celebrated again in Kansas. A man could do no better than to be associated with beautiful Jayhawk women and William Allen White, who still remains such an icon of journalism. And I do appreciate the fact that I am the first person to have received this who's devoted most of my journalistic work to sports writing. As a sports writer, I've always been cynical. When some player wins an award like the Most Valuable Player, and then he makes a big modest deal out of, oh, I could not have done this without the help of my teammates. Please, please. Well, I'm not so humble as to accept this on behalf of all sports writers all time. But believe me, I'm sincere in saying that I feel that this honor for me does recognize, if obliquely, sports journalism, which I believe sometimes is too often overlooked. But I understand. As Jimmy Cannon, who was a truly great sports writer, a wonderful man of words, he commented once, "We are the toy shop of the profession." And that's true. What we cover, for the most part, is fun. Fun and games. Not serious enough. And that's fair enough. Even if I do believe, without getting highfalutin about it, that sports is important culturally. The fact that it is found in every society throughout humankind history must mean something. Yes, religion and sex are also found in every culture, and I wouldn't rate sports quite so high as that. But yes, it does matter. Sports writing, though, is usually presumed to be somehow different than, shall we say, real writing, it didn't occur to me until very recently in my life that of all the titles in journalism, only sports writer as written in one word. I noted this ruefully in my memoir. A few examples. Police reporter, two words. Movie critic, two words. Editorial writer, war correspondent, even sports editor, two words. But sports writer is co-joined, as if you just simply cannot separate the narrator and the subject. There may also be a certain amount of envy that's applied here, because I will acknowledge this, it's a dirty little secret, that sports writing really is the easiest writing in the whole canon of journalism. Just think, it's full of drama, plot, denouement, climax, somebody wins, somebody loses, glamour, entertainment, character, novelty, humor, heroes, and the heroes are invariably young and callow, ready to have words put in their mouth, which is the dream of every journalist ever. Now, we are not without our faults. We can sometimes miss the forest for the trees. First, despite the fact that in the recent past, there have been two things in America that have come to the mind as most egregiously incorrect. First, no matter how hard we looked, there were not, as we promised the world, any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And second, despite how hard we sports writers failed to look, there were all sorts of performance-enhancing drugs in baseball and all other sports. That's our shame. I think, as a group, can be too accepting, sports writers. Even most recently, in being stunned to discover that men and boys can hurt their heads playing football. What a shock. Now, of course, through the years, this was visible to us all, to coaches, to fans, to doctors, as well as to journalists. We just didn't want to acknowledge what was so patently clear, how to deal with fun and games. We're conflicted. One good example, Taylor Branch, a magnificent reporter who won the Pulitzer Prize for writing about Martin Luther King, dipped into sports long enough a year or so ago to completely undress the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Now, this is not the forum for me to get into my feelings about the NCAA and what undergirds it, which is amateurism, which is a fraud and evil. But the point is, just in passing, the point is that since Mr. Branch's revelations and accusations, there's been hardly any follow-up in our business. The men and women who cover the teams who play in the NCAA have gone about their business dutifully covering the teams, the games, and never mind even mentioning the hypocritical cartel that runs them so ineptly and so infamously. But I understand that. I understand. Nobody wants to hear. Nobody wants to read in the same way about football players who are having their brains knocked out of them. And just as an aside, what I lament so much about sports writing, modern-day sports writing, is the overwhelming dependence upon statistics. You know, for better or for worse, sports does lend itself so well to storytelling. Only love and war and fairy tales make for better stories, I suppose. And there is, in sports, an embrace of all of those. There's love in sports and war in sports, and there are fairy tales in sports. And it enrages me to see stories that are overwhelmed instead by just passionless numbers. Now, that indulgence, overindulgence of numbers aside, I do believe that we have come, as they say in horse racing, we have come a distance of ground. When I entered the profession, which I should say I had no real intention of remaining in it for a long time. It's another example of how life does take you sometimes by just by the scruff of the neck. But when I came into the profession, sports journalism was not looked upon with the greatest of respect. There were a lot of editors who were on the take. Even the best and most honest of them served more as chamber of commerce types than they did as journalists. Good grief, in San Diego, they even named a stadium after a beloved sports writer. There were hack writers who dearly loved sports, but who had no talent to buttress that affection that they had. For some reason, probably because long ago we thought that it would somehow make our subject more important if we wrote about it in a fancier language, sports writing early on tended toward the florid and the rococo, what one critic called like a bad dream by Sir Walter Scott. And likewise, we've always had too many sympathetic homers, and this was especially true away from the big cities and the major league professional teams. Reporters who cover the teams were all too often more like PR assistants than working reporters. And we were, of course, all men. Part of that was sure sheer misogyny, but part of it was complicated by a curiosity of our profession, which is alone in the United States, that we often interviewed the people we were talking to when they were buck naked. Now, let me tell you, it takes a while to get used to that. In my experience, there are some conversations that are wonderful that you can have when both parties are clothed, and there are some wonderful conversations you can have when both parties are unclothed. But halvesies is just something that you have nothing in your experience. But never mind. We introduced modesty to our conversations and thereby allowed females into the locker rooms. But good grief, when I started as a sports writer, never mind locker rooms, they didn't even let women into the press boxes. So altogether, yes, we are a much more progressive body of workers than we were when I stumbled into this profession so many years ago. Of course, so much has happened in all of journalism the past few years. Now, I was very surprised in reading Mr. White's memoirs that he made a point of how much newspapers changed in his lifetime. And of course, above all, he was a newspaper man. I had the feeling myself, though, that once Mr. Mergenthaler invented his linotype press in the late 19th century, that not a hell of a lot happened around newspapers for the next six or seven decades. They just seemed to be there. Newsprint that came off on your fingers, black and white, thrown upon the porch by some neighbor boy who miraculously appeared out of the blue on a bicycle. And you picked up the newspaper and you read them. It was all pretty basic. Even when I was in college, I set headline type myself for my college newspaper. My first real job in the business was as a copy boy at the old Baltimore Evening Sun. Mencken's paper itself, and much of my spare time when I was not answering cries of copy over and copy down, what was to sit in the corner putting together little copy booklets, alternating pages of carbon paper. Good Lord, whoever remembers carbon paper today? But I'm sure that copy boys had made those booklets for Mencken himself generations before. And in that way, it just seemed that the print world would go on the same forever and ever and ever. Oh, but oh my. What has happened lately? I have the dubious honor of being the editor of the last great newspaper experience in this nation. Now, I must assert at this point that this is the only time in my life that I was an editor. As a writer, and still as a writer, I have fought tooth and nail with editors all of my life. I generally subscribe to what General Sherman had to say about the profession. When a man is too lazy to work and too cowardly to steal, he becomes a newspaper editor. And then, one day, I suddenly was a newspaper editor, the editor of America's first and only sports daily, The National. We lasted 18 months and lost $150 million. That's hard to do in 18 months. Without boring you with the details, we were a terrific editorial product, but we were idiots when it came to commerce. Essentially, nobody had figured out ahead of time how much it costs to deliver newspapers to people's houses, which is where they expected them when they woke up in the morning. Neighbor boys on bicycles did not ply that trade anymore in 1990. It was 20 years ago. And what amazes me, though, is that people still tell me, boy, if the internet had only been around back then, you'd have been great for the internet. And what I always say is, yeah, we'd have been great for the internet, but the internet would not have been great for us. Because, of course, the problem is that the internet kills newspapers. But I just nod and say, yes, isn't that the truth? Isn't that a shame? It's the same as people always ask me, how the internet has changed sports journalism, as if somehow we're different from the rest of journalism. The internet is surely the most important advance in communication since Mr. Gutenberg's invention. I don't think that sports has been affected in any unique fashion. If anything, in fact, because they keep score at games, because it's so simple, because it's transparent, the internet may have treated sport better than most topics, which can be more easily distorted. 40 years ago, the great historian Daniel Boorstin wrote that the world was being surfeited by what he called then pseudo-events. And soon enough, Mr. Boorstin said, there were only two things that would be left that were really real: crime and sport. And given that this was before O.J. Simpson and Lance Armstrong, Mr. Boorstin was particularly prescient. But really, the changes that the internet have wrought have affected us in sports, but pretty much like everybody else. The beauty of the newspaper and the magazine, right on down to the Ed Sullivan Show, for those of you who may remember that, it was that all these displays were so eclectic. Newspapers. William Allen White's, what we always used to say, that old joke, what's black and white and red all over? And the red all over is the key part. All sorts of different things were thrown in your face, and if you weren't interested in a certain subject, you at least had the first glance at that page before you might decide to turn it to another. Just as if you weren't interested when Ed Sullivan brought out the opera diva, you at least listened to her until Senior Wences came on next. And maybe you learned to appreciate opera a little in the bark. This has always been the same beauty of newspaper. There were bits and pieces of everything. That was what William Allen White must have loved, even if he didn't give a hoot about sports itself. Now, there was another famous writer, another Pulitzer Prize winner, who graduated from this university and who, like Mr. White, was known for expressing the sense, the mood of the Midwest. That was William Inge, the playwright, a man who apparently was as tortured as Mr. White was comfortable with everything in his life. But in Mr. Inge's most famous work, for which he won the Pulitzer, Picnic, which now has a wonderful revival on Broadway, by the way, the play begins in a small Kansas town like Mr. White's Emporia, with that newspaper boy on that bicycle delivering the morning paper. That's how picnic begins. The Kansas Day, the Midwest Day, the All-American Day, mid-century America, with a newspaper coming to your house. It's so simple, almost too much so. There are two sisters there on stage. One is absolutely beautiful, but hopelessly incurious. Kim Novak played her in the movie. And the other sister, plain, but bright and inquisitive. And the boy chucks the paper onto the porch. And the plain sister, Millie, retrieves it. And she sits down on the porch swing there and starts to go through the pages, black and white and red all over. And that simple set piece that starts picnic is just so evocative and so telling what Millie might have stumbled on in that paper that day. And you see, it wouldn't happen today. It wouldn't happen. Millie wanted to be an artist. Today, I suspect, she would have her iPad out there on the swing going through dedicated, God, how I've come to hate that word, dedicated, going through dedicated art websites. And however much she might learn more about art, too much of the rest of the world would pass her by. Today, even in sports, there is this a la carte process that dominates so much of our thinking. Ironically, the broadband, in many respects, has made us narrower. The web has made us more direct and less encompassing. And in the process, of course, language has been devalued. Pictures have replaced words to such an extent that even though we may use the written word more than ever as we communicate by email, it's a snappy, cut-rate argo that we employ, merely a sort of a modern sign language. I worry that we're creating a large class of college-educated people, yes, but those who might be called optionally illiterate, which is to say that they have learned to read and write, but really choose not to. Texting is not writing. No. The best writing is seduction. And sports writing sometimes can be downright lustful. Texting is the literary equivalent of air kissing. Those of us in journalism love above all to quote and quote and quote again and again Thomas Jefferson's famous remark, "Were it left for me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate to prefer the latter." Oh, hooray for our team. Thank you so much, dear Mr. Jefferson. But in fact, what we don't often mention is that thought was followed by another one. Mr. Jefferson concluded, "But I should mean that every man should receive these papers and be capable of reading them." Jefferson was talking, you see, about education first. Journalism was more on the side. We are now more, allegedly, educated than ever before. 80% of us have high school educations. A century ago, that figure was only 6%. 25% have baccalaureate degrees today in America. But if we choose optional literacy, what does all this education matter? So at the end of the day, yes, sports writing will endure because lots of people love sports and want to know more and more about them. And I don't worry about the future of sports writing, and for that matter, I don't worry about the future of sports reading. We'll be fine. However, I do worry, as I believe William Allen White would worry, about that inquisitive young girl sitting on the porch swing somewhere in a small town in Kansas, and the newspaper boy doesn't come by anymore to chuck that newspaper on the porch. So for all the information that's out there now, just overwhelming us in some respects, we don't know how to get at what used to be just thrown to us on the front porch. Information is so much more convenient today, but ironically, we have to work harder to educate ourselves. A challenge as journalists in the future is going to be just not how to inform people, but how to make people more curious again about other stuff. Now, as Yogi Berra, and what would a sports writer's speech be without a citation to you? Yogi and Phil Rizzuto were tooling down the road going to a dinner in New Jersey a few years ago. And Rizzuto began to get worried. Yogi, he said, I think we're lost. Yeah, Yogi said, but we're making such good time. And with that is my scripture. I'm going to stop now. But in the few minutes that we have left, I would welcome having some questions from you all. Thank you so very much for listening.
You're listening to sports writer Frank DeFord on Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Two quick questions, if I may. One, are professional tennis players randomly tested for performance-enhancing substances?
Yes, they are.
And secondly, in collegiate and professional basketball, should the baskets be raised to 12 feet?
People have suggested that through the years, and the answer is, the guy who's 7 feet tall would still be taller. And everybody loves a dunk. You know, if you watch ESPN, that's all you see. Dunk, 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 dunk.
I'm curious of your assessment of the whole situation from a journalist's point of view with the Manti Te'o and whether journalists were doing their job.
I think everybody was just so easily taken in by it. The story about the Notre Dame kid who had the make-believe girlfriend. Because some things are so fantastic, you don't doubt them. I would have doubted it because for 18 months this beautiful girl was in touch with him and he never made any effort to see her. And that was extraordinary to me as a man. This beautiful woman saying, I love you, I adore you, and he wouldn't go see her. So maybe if I'd done the story, I would have been onto it. But I just think the whole thing was so crazy that nobody stopped and said, this can't be. You question little things, and something as large as that, I suppose, gets bias. That's all I can say. It's a baffling thing. It's a puzzlement. Thank you all so very much. It's been my pleasure.
You've just heard sports journalist Frank DeFord from the 2013 William Allen White Day at the University of Kansas. DeFord was the first and only sports writer to win the prestigious award honoring an American journalist. DeFord recently announced his retirement after 37 years on NPR's Morning Edition. You can hear his final NPR commentary, as well as several stories about his career, at npr.org. Before that, we heard from this year's William Allen White Day with CBS newsman Bob Schieffer. Schieffer accepted the 2017 National Citation on behalf of his friend and colleague, Charlie Rose. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.